Thank you for coming to class. So let's begin with an arriving meditation. And the invitation always is to find a posture in your body that feels good to you. Whether you're seated, whether you're standing, whether you're reclining, it's entirely up to you, but in a way that you can hold yourself in your body in a way that is attentive, awake, eyes open or eyes closed. It doesn't work for everybody to have closed eyes. So if you prefer open eyes, it's a downward gaze. Try a soft downward gaze. And just letting the face relax. And as the face relaxes, see if that relaxation can gently move down the body, letting the muscles of the belly go, getting a sense of connection, those touch points in the body, whether you're connected to the floor or the furniture, through the feet or the legs. Sensing some groundedness. And at the same time that you sense this groundedness, these touch points, also notice how the spine grows tall out of the deep low back. Whether you're reclining or sitting or vertical or horizontal, just noticing the length of the spine. How it comes up through the neck to the crown of the head. And holding just enough strength in the back body to stay awake and attentive. And softening the whole front of the body so there's room to breathe. And as you sense into this breath, be attentive to the inhale, attentive to the exhale, and even noticing the light, slight pause before the next inhale. Arriving with the inhale, settling with the exhale. Short breath, long breath, shallow or deep. Let yourself know the breathing, becoming present right here. And here again. Opening to this moment. Let's sit quietly. And as you continue to arrive and settle, different sensations may show themselves. Sensations that are both comfortable or uncomfortable. And if you need to adjust the body, adjust the body. Meeting yourself right where you are, seeing what's here. And in this arriving and settling, inviting a quality of listening, turning this awareness inwards. Becoming still, quieting. There's a poem called Climbing the Golden Mountain from Michael Kiesel Moore. Listen, turn everything off. When the noise of our lives drifts away, when the chatter of our minds sinks into that perfect lake of nothing, then, oh, then we can apprehend that golden mountain, always there, waiting for us to be still enough to hear it. What is it that we hear when we're still enough? And as we sit quietly, I want to offer you a couple of reflection questions just to see what comes up. There's no judgment at all. I'm just noticing what has perhaps given you pause lately. Might be something wholesome, something unwholesome, something lovely, something not. Something that made you pause. Whether it was difficult or pleasant, comfortable, uncomfortable, how did you respond? Somewhere along that continuum line between reactivity and responsiveness, what happened for you? And what supported your process of being with anything that gave you pause? And coming back to your body. Breathing. Remembering why you're here. Then imagine hearing a bell. And blinking your eyes open when you're ready. Welcome back. I don't have my bell with me today, so we all know what the bell sounds like, and sometimes Carlita will ring it for us. Oh, I do love an arriving meditation. I find it so beneficial for bridging whatever I was doing before into coming into our time of practice. And I so appreciate that Carlita calls this our 2-hour retreat, because it is. It totally is. I love that. So I asked you those questions about what has given you pause lately, something that maybe you just, you know, just took a pause and went, huh. Was it something that was comfortable? Was it something that was uncomfortable? Because I want to talk later after our longer meditation about the 5 spiritual strengths, which are faith, energy, concentration, wisdom, and mindfulness. And what are those, how do those strengths maybe show up for you? So when I asked that question, what gave you pause and what did you do about it? Where was it on the spectrum of reactivity or responsiveness? And what was it that helped you meet that moment? Because I think that there are these strengths in our practices that really do show up. And I wonder if anybody would be willing to pop on and say, if there's something that did give you pause in recent times that you did work with in some way or another, that you'd be willing to share about it. Yeah, Nancy, please.
I have been doing a lot of work on elections for the past month or so, and it was with a great deal of apprehension. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of negativity out there that I was exposed to because I was contacting voters and getting lots of negative reactions back. And I've made a conscious decision to try to find the pleasant rather than the unpleasant. And so having that intention makes me more open to the beautiful things that I do see. This morning, I went out for an early bike ride, and it was a full moon last night, and the moon was setting in the west. I was riding direct east. And so from the moment I woke up and I could see the moonlight coming through my window at 5 o'clock this morning, I knew it was going to be a beautiful ride. And what I find is the way I react to those does not take a conscious effort on my part. I find myself smiling. I see the moon and I smile. I'm riding along and the side of the road is barren, and all of a sudden there's a patch of flowers there. And I look at them and I just smile. It's just my consciousness, automatic recognition of the pleasant in my life. And it's out there. It's out there.
It is. And when you start with that kind of conscious intention, it's powerful. And especially when you've been doing this for a while, and it's like I think we condition our minds and our hearts to see the good in even within the difficult, all the negativity, like you said. And so that's how do you credit practice for being able to do that?
So one of my practices is during my walking meditation in the morning, I say the refuges and the precepts and the 5 recollections and the daily vows, which is something that Temple Smith got me started on when I was taking an intensive class from him. And one of the intentions has to do with wise effort. It has 2 parts. And when he originally gave us the vows, it only had the negative part, which is we practice to prevent and abandon all activities of body, speech, and mind based in numbness, hatred, and greed. And I realized after the study of wise effort that there's a positive side to it. And so the positive side is we practice to develop and maintain wholesome states of body, state, and mind. So that is one of my daily intentions. That's just beautiful. Kind of helps keep it top of mind.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's such a powerful practice. I wonder if you would mind chatting those daily vows, sending them to Carlita, and then Carlita can put them up for everybody. Would that be all right with you, Nancy?
I'll just pop them into the chat.
That would be great. Yeah. Thank you so much. So sure. This is my point, is that, you know, it's been a lot politically lately. And wherever you may land in your own beliefs and values, wherever you are, it's been challenging. So it just has been. And here we are, the day after Election Day. And part of what I am feeling with it is certainly some relief that we got past yesterday. No matter what, we got past this big buildup of what is going to happen on November 8th. And you know, whenever there's some big event, and it doesn't have to be something as big as a national election, it can be anything in one's life that we're coming up on something that is really important to you. And there is that sense of getting to that point and then, okay, we got there, and we can get on the other side of it. And when we get on the other side of it, there's some rebalancing that happens. There's a breath that can be taken, or 500 breaths that can be taken. But it requires support, I believe. It requires support of, in my life, a practice that's reliable, things that are reliable that I can go to, that help me maintain my balance and my perspective. And that can be difficult. So this is why we'll look at these five strengths today. And I love how you laid that out for us, Nancy. That was great. So with that, I want to read you a piece. This is a story that came out of one of Mark Nepo's books. And this is an excerpt from the story. Catoot was a great teacher because she claimed to know nothing. Many wanted to work with her. Some would make long journeys in hopes of studying with her, but she disavowed any notion that she accepted students. To those who showed up, she'd simply say, "Let's just walk together for a while and listen." Three young seekers met in Amsterdam on their way to find her: Gail, a potter from Tucson, Ben, a financial advisor from Dallas, and Jane, a yoga instructor from Portland. Gail said, "I heard she's very quiet." And Ben added, "I heard she doesn't take very many students." And Jane worried to herself that she might be stern. They shrugged and laughed and made their way. A week later, they were sitting with Catoot on a plateau near her small home, which overlooked a meandering river. She began, "You've come a long way to meet yourself." Ben was eager. "There's so much I want to know." And Catoot replied, "You know, there's a line in the Talmud that reads, 'Why ruin a perfectly good question with the answer?'" And Gail spoke up, "Are there no answers then?" And Catoot went on, "Life unravels the urge to look for an answer. Instead, we're asked to think of questions as teachers to walk with. We're asked to meet questions, not answer them. To give questions away like bread." So finding that question that you can say, what is here now? What is the next kindest thing to do? Or when you're in a place that says, "I don't really know what to do." Okay. I don't know what to do. Why ruin a perfectly good question with an answer? You know, this goes to this piece of art that this practice is a journey. There's no there. We keep showing up over and over and over again because there's something inside that says, there's something going on with this practice that is really supporting me. I don't know exactly what it is, or maybe you do know exactly what it is, but there's a pull that's happening. And this is the practice of faith or confidence or trust that we're willing to, with Sangha, with the support of one another, explore these questions and not have to have the answer. So there's this piece of trusting this practice that includes the ground of practice, the path of practice, the fruit of practice. So the ground is, why are you here? Right? What brings you to practice? Is there a longing? Is there some sense of discovery that is happening? And as you show up every single time to Sangha, or you sit on your cushion, or somehow this practice of the Dharma is supporting you, that becomes this fertile ground out of which your path can continue to to grow and to arise. And so the path, what are the efforts that we make to keep going and what supports those efforts? You know, there's this path, there's the path that discovers the truth of the Four Noble Truths, that life is difficult for everybody. Suffering is real. We have some choice and we need the practices to help us resolve our understanding of what's the difference between pain and suffering. The truth of how we experience change and impermanence, how that works. The truth that one thing leads to the next, right? Our interconnection or karma. The other thing that happens that's so beautiful that I hope you get glimpses of is that you start to, I think that we start to discover deeper and deeper our inner nobility, this inner goodness, this Buddha nature that is true. You know, there's a gorgeous invocation that many meditations begin with that says, "O nobly born, you who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, remember who you are. The luminous mind, the goodness of heart, trust it, return to it. It is home." This is the path that starts revealing itself, is that our goodness of heart and mind. And that then nurtures this ground, the clarity of mind, the mindfulness that happens. It's said that this is a path of purification. And the way I understand and relate to that is that as we deepen and understand more and more the causes of greed and ill will and delusion, that we start disentangling from that. And that becomes the path. And then it's a cycle. The path, the more we learn, it nurtures the ground. And then there are the fruits that arise from this is what we learn. What has changed you? Which is why I brought in that reflection question of what has given you pause lately and what have you noticed in it and what have you done about it? Is there some amount of impulse control that is happening? And that is a real thing. You know, and sometimes people will say to me, "So Heidi, you've been in this practice a long time. What is it that you're really learning?" And that is a very real thing that I'm learning is impulse control. I don't have to react so quickly. I do have more capacity to pause, to let whatever feeling is here, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, to be here. So then I have more choice about what I want to do next. That ability to think it over. Somebody said to me recently, when he encounters difficulty with others, he said, "Just show him more love. Just show him more love." Actually really wise. And we could unpack that a little bit, but that's another way of saying pause and be kind. Don't take it personally. So learning that, as the Zen teaching goes, when we fall down on the ground, it's the ground that helps us up. We start trusting this ground and trusting this path. And transformation happens through this ground, path, and fruit, and showing up over and over again. But you have to step into the path to do it. Robin Wall Kimmerer, who wrote Braiding Sweetgrass, this is what she says about transformation. She says, "Transformation is not accomplished by tentative waiting at the edge." Transformation is not accomplished by tentative waiting at the edge. We actually have to step in and show up. Because everything is so uncertain, because we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. So we do need to show up today. And we are, you know, all of the buildup to the election. And again, no matter where you are, we showed up today. We showed up for this practice that we do together that supports us. So let's move into our meditation now, and we'll be here for about 25 minutes or so. So please find again a posture that works for you. Let it be comfortable. Let yourself feel supported. Whether you're seated or standing or reclining, eyes open or eyes closed, On your next exhale, releasing into this moment, and I mean softening any muscles that can be softened over and over again, yet sensing the strength of the body, the back body especially, letting the front body soften, this soft receptivity, and breathing in, knowing you're breathing in, breathing out, knowing you're breathing out, relaxing. Sensing the groundedness of the body by noticing the touch points where the body is touching whatever you're sitting on, the floor, the chair, the furniture, whatever it is. Those touch points offer some grounding. Reminder, I am here. Noticing the motion the body makes in response to breathing. The expansion and relaxing back of the belly and the chest. Maybe you notice the rise and fall of the shoulders as the lungs fill and empty. Or the touch of your clothing on the skin that might move just slightly as you breathe. Or maybe it's the air going in and out of the nostrils. You might become aware of sounds close by or further away. These are all ways to stabilize the mind, whether you rest your awareness in the body and sensation, or the breath itself, or sound. Steadying your attention on one of these places . It's akin to pedaling. Pedaling a bicycle is a way to get momentum and balance, and using this anchor to come back over and over again for steady balance of the mind. At some point, you'll begin to coast. Then the mind is steady. And then when the mind wanders, coming back, beginning again, like pedaling again, balancing, coasting, coming back. And we'll sit quietly. sometimes as the mind is quieting, the body can start to tighten into habitual ways and before we even notice it. So if there's any place in your own body, maybe the jaw or the belly or the hands that are starting to tighten in any way, soften any amount. Just notice, oh, constriction, tightening, release, and come back. As we continue to sit quietly, you might notice a certain amount of stillness arising. Let it be there. Let that stillness support you. continuing to stay very present with your own body, the quieting of the mind and the softening of the heart. Staying here. I'll offer you this poem to just bring in to your meditation to accompany you. It's called Right Here from Dane Anthony. Stop moving. Stand in one place, this place. Breathe slowly in, then out. Repeat. Repeat again. Let your shoulders sink and relax. Unclench your jaw. Slowly close your eyes. Listen for your heartbeat. Really listen. Feel it pulse in your fingertips. Lessen expectations. Underdo all your efforts. Requisition the time for your soul to catch up. Lean into the wind. Feel it like a tree and test the ground. Learn to trust the resilience. It would be treason to move quickly left or right from this place. It's all right to be exactly what you are, who you are, where you are, right here, right now. Staying with this, right here, right now. It is all right to be exactly what you are, who you are, where you are, right here, right now. So once again, sensing into the body, this breathing body, this heart and mind, your whole being. Offering yourself some metta. May I be well. May I feel contented. May I be at ease. May I be well. May I be contented. May I be at ease. Okay, thank you, everybody. Let's take 5 minutes, and then we'll come back and talk with each other some more. So please come back at whatever 5 minutes is from now, after the hour. Thank you. Okay, welcome back, everybody. All right, so I want to talk about these five spiritual strengths today, because they are, like many of the Buddha's lists that we come across in practice, they are foundational, and they can give us some very real structure for approaching practice, but also why practice is important. And this is a piece for me in my own practice that, if you've been in class with me before, you've heard me say, I want to know why this practice matters. All we can do all the theorizing we want, and we can understand lists, and we can understand this practice conceptually. But what is really important to me is, how is it supporting my life? What is happening here? So when I think about, you know, a really big like week that we've been in with this political, with the election, and all of the different emotions and energy around that, what I need is some bedrock. I know that I need the bedrock of my practice and the stability, so I do have the ability to be with all the craziness, you know, all of the intensity of it that is just true. It doesn't matter what the belief systems are. It's just the intensity of the whole experience. And so that's what made me think of these five spiritual faculties, or these five spiritual strengths. And what they are is faith. And faith from Buddhist practice does not mean faith in an external deity. What it means is confidence or trust. The Pali word is sadha, S-A-D-D-H-A. And sometimes it's translated on as to place the heart upon. And I truly love that definition of faith, to place the heart upon. I have deeply placed my heart upon this practice because it supports me. I can trust it. I have confidence in this. And the second of these faculties is energy, the literal volitional energy that we bring to, no, I'm going to keep coming back. I'm going to keep doing this. When we sit in meditation and the mind goes somewhere else and maybe the energy falters and we get really sleepy, there's a way in which we pick ourselves up by our bootstraps and stick a little turbo in there. Like literally that persistence, that virya. Mindfulness is the third of these faculties, this awareness of whatever is happening right now. Stillness, needing to be still, or the concentrated mind, or samadhi, and we'll go back to all of these. And the last is wisdom. What is growing out of this, right? What is growing out of this faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, the gathering of the mind? There's this quality of wisdom that grows that says, oh, this is what I know to be true, this discernment. And so sometimes these five faculties are thought of as like a team of horses. This is just a metaphor for a visualization of how these all work together. And if you've been around this practice even a little bit and you hear about the different lists, you probably start to see that many of these different avenues of practice show up on different lists, and they work together. They're interconnected, they're interwoven. So the lead horse, think of this as this team of horse, this lead horse is mindfulness. And then the pair, the first pair, is thought of as faith and wisdom. And then the pair in the back is energy and concentration. So when faith and wisdom and energy and concentration are in balance and they're working together, the mindfulness is effortless, because it's supported by faith and wisdom and energy and concentration. And so then this clear, responsive mind that is out in front of the support system is effortless. It's just there. It's just there. So let's start with talking a little bit about faith, trust, confidence, to place the heart upon. There are a lot of ways to think about this. And in our practice, it's often said that there are several different kinds of faith, and we're not going to go into a long discussion of that today, but there's what's called bright faith, which is that sense of, oh, I'm learning something new. This is where I belong. This is so exciting. A kind of new infatuation where you get that sense of you're all in, you're all in. It's just great until something falters and you go, I don't know about this so much. I don't know if this whole thing is working. And then you need a little borrowed faith where you say, okay, I'm going to go to Sangha, because if I go to Sangha, I'm going to be with other people who are also in this practice, and that will support me. And over time, what starts to emerge is what's thought of as verified or abiding faith. Oh, right. You start learning. Oh, you prove it to yourself. Yes, if I keep coming back over and over again, there's a steadiness that arises. There's a clarity. And that's how faith and confidence and trust grow. And it might be confidence in the teachings of the Buddha. It might be confidence in teachers, trusting teachers. But ultimately, what we're doing is developing this confidence and trust and faith in ourselves, in our own capacity to show up, to manage the cycles of reactivity and responsiveness, comfort, discomfort, love and fear, all of it. We start really trusting our own capacity to meet our lives exactly as they are. And that's where we come to this, in this teaching from the Buddha that says, Ehi Pasiko, come and find out for yourself. Sit and be still. When you're out moving around and you're out moving and around, still observe and be present. You start learning from every one of your experiences, whether you're seated or in meditation or out in your daily life. This builds confidence, builds trust. Here's a sweet piece from Terry Tempest Williams from her book called When Women Were Birds. In the arid foothills of the Wasatch Mountains, this is in Utah, the Milky Way arched over us. It was the nightly path our eyes crossed before we went to sleep. This was my personal universe with its own inherent truths. Truth for me was based on what I could see and hear and touch and taste, more trustworthy than any religious doctrine. Rufous-sided towhees scratched in the understory of last year's leaves. Lazuli buntings were turquoise exclamation marks singing in a canopy of green, and blue-gray gnatcatchers became commas in an ongoing narrative of wild nature. My inspiration was winged. Magpies, evening grosbeaks, and scrub jays were family. Turkey vultures soared overhead, casting unexpected shadows during summer heat. Rattlesnakes were our complication to a life lived outside. We heard them first, saw them second, coiled, and before we counted to three, we ran. Clouds became our focal point for change. One day, however, as I was sitting in our treehouse, I spotted a white bird perched directly above me. It was unlike anything I'd ever seen. I went into the house to call my grandmother, still watching the ghost bird through the glass sliding doors that faced the trees. I explained the size and shape of this mysterious bird to be that of a robin, only without a brown back, black head, and red breast. She listened carefully. We both had our bird books in hand. Perhaps it's an albino, she said. A bird without pigmentation, even its eyes without color. That very word, albino, was a revelation to me. She might as well have said, of the spirit world. It indeed was a robin, the most common of birds, free of its prescribed dressings, white with red eyes. I was inspired and called her the Holy Ghost. When I reported this finding to our local Audubon chapter as an 8-year-old bird watcher, the president said that because of my age, he could not legitimately count it as a credible sighting. My grandmother simply shook her head and said, "You know what you saw. The bird doesn't need to be counted, and neither do you." That is that kind of trust, that kind of faith that we develop. You know what you saw. And that piece of, you don't need to be counted, the bird doesn't need to be counted, and neither do you, that wasn't meant negatively. That's saying, you know who you are. Back to that poem. Wherever you are, whoever you are, whatever you are, you have a right to be here. You know what you saw. So this growing confidence, this trust, this is what we're talking about as a spiritual strength. It's critically important. And sometimes it wanes. Sometimes we don't feel the trust. We don't feel the confidence. So we come back to Sangha because this is where we're held. Whatever your Sanghas might be, you know, Sangha, this community in which you are seen and part of and where awakening can unfold to unfold together. But it's any community in which you are a part of that's valuable to you. It might be your book club, might be your bike riding club. It's a form of a Sangha. So we're not, at least I am not holding up this Sangha as the only place in which we are held and supported. It's a very important place. But there are a lot of ways in which we can create community in which we are supported and seen. So virya, the next of these faculties, virya is energy, V-I-R-I-Y-A. And it is literally that volitional force that keeps us going, that keeps us going. It's a kind of persistence that we need to draw on when the energy wanes, or sometimes we're really wound up and we need to bring it down. So are you pressing on the gas pedal or are you pulling off? You know, like finding that place, not too tight, not too loose. And that comes with time, that comes with skill. And it could be that we come to a meditation practice and there's a lot of energy and we're, you know, sitting up very tight, very straight and really trying to focus, but there's so much constriction around it. We can't breathe. And so, you know, the great teacher, Sayadaw Utejaniya, who said, just relax, just relax. And I really appreciate that teaching. I want to be attentive yet relaxed. And then the mind can settle and I'm putting extra pressure on myself. So we're working on that. You know, we figure that out all the time. What is enough energy to stay awake and present? And how can I also soften? It reminds me of, there was a time where I used to row a lot. I used to row crew and I used to row singles. And as an adult, not in college, I got involved in a recreational rowing in my community. And I'm not a competitive person. I actually really don't care about competing and kind of like go the other way. If I have to compete, I'm just like, ew, I don't want to do this. I just want to do it for fun. Well, not everybody in the boat felt the way I felt. Especially the coach who, I mean, there's a bunch of, you know, at the time, there's mostly women between 40 and 70 who are in these boats coming out on a Sunday morning to have a lot of fun. And row. And that's all I wanted to do. And I really didn't care about anything except really having a good time. So I remember one day, you know, well, let me just back up. You know, it's really important in a boat like that, that everybody is working together to stay on keel. Otherwise you dump over, you can't get anywhere if everybody isn't working together and rowing together and the bodies are together. And it's beautiful sport. Really beautiful sport. So we're out there rowing in the middle of the bay and the coach is in this other boat, motorboat, riding along us. And I hear him yell, Born! And I'm like, who's Born? Like, nobody calls me by my last name. That's just so weird. It's like, to me, I just couldn't relate to this, but this was this coach yelling, Born, put something on it. Like put something on it, like, you know, get it together, stick a little turbo in there. I'm laughing about it now, but I was just like, it's Sunday morning and I'm just out here and I just want to row and I don't have to go fast. Anyway, I had to learn to put something on it. And that was really a great experience of energy and virya and how do you work together and bring that energy and then I really ramped it up and we were doing a sprint one morning, or it was a practice where we would go really hard as we could for a minute, and then back off for a minute, on for a minute, off for a minute, on for a minute. So I learned to give it everything I had on that on for a minute. And I tore my knee up. I ended up tearing the meniscus in my knee because I gave it literally everything I had, because he said, "Born, put something on it." So that was an example of too much. And anyway, I think about that because there is a certain amount of energy that is necessary to keep ourselves on keel, right? A certain amount of balance. So just using that rowing story as a metaphor for, we need to keep a certain amount of energy going, certainly in meditation practice, to stay awake, to stay present, to stay balanced. And then when the energy is off, we maybe fall asleep and we're really not attentive, or where it's too tight, or we have way too many expectations about, what am I going to get out of this particular sit? Or I'm just going to go to sleep. I'm just going to sit here and let my mind trail off. So this practice of playing with what is the right amount of energy to bring to meditation, or the right amount of energy to bring to any interaction, so we stay balanced and clear. And so I offer you that story just because it was emblematic of much more, I think, of really how this works. And we can make things worse, right? The state of my mind can affect how choppy, if I'm not in balance and I am not bringing a steadiness to whatever it is I'm doing, there's a choppiness, there's a lack of clarity, a turbulence that can happen. So that's a way to think about energy and virya. And the third of these, mindfulness. So, you know, we talk about mindfulness all the time, this clear seeing, this vipassana, or sati. And sati is the Pali word that's often translated as mindfulness. And I learned from Bhikkhu Anālayo that a really beautiful translation of sati is soft receptivity, a soft receptivity of mind. And I really love that. And I use that in my own practice all the time. When my mind and heart and body, there's a quality of a soft receptivity, that makes space for the mindfulness, the clear, friendly awareness to arise, to be present. But I need some softness. I need to have that receptivity present for the mindfulness to arise. And then with that presence of mind, I can ask myself questions like, what am I aware of? What am I noticing right now? How do I feel it in my body? Or in the moment of getting maybe a little bit, a little clench in the mind, a little activated, I can know to pause when that sati is present. I can have that presence of mind to pause. I like this piece from Stephen Hawking. He said, "Remember to look up at the stars and not down at your feet. Try to make some sense of what you see and wonder about what makes the universe even exist. Be curious. And however difficult life may seem, there's always something you can do and succeed at. It matters that you don't just give up." I love that. And to put together faith and energy and mindfulness into, be curious, look up at the stars, know you can do this. It might be difficult, but there's always something you can do. And if the thing that you can do is take the next breath, that's the thing that you can do. Concentration, the fourth of these faculties, translated from the word samadhi, SAMADHI, which means a non-distracted awareness. And that is what does get cultivated through meditation. And even if you notice every once in a while as you're sitting in meditation, this happens to me, oh, the mind is so concentrated. And as soon as I know it, boom, it's not as concentrated as it was, because it's just how it goes. But that this often traditionally called, talked about as gathering and collecting the mind. When we sit down to bring all those tendrils of attention back here, right back here. And so through this process of, like I described, pedaling and coasting, pedaling, you know, it, letting the attention stay with the breath or sensations or listening, this place where the mind can come back to over and over again, it settles, right? It really settles. And then it naturally opens out to a, like coasting. And then we lose our balance, and, you know, mind starts making grocery lists, and then we come back and come back. And the value of cultivating this quiet, concentrated mind is that it's often out of that place that wisdom arises. That's where the insights come from, when the mind is quiet and collected enough, where there's not so much chatter going on, that there are deepening understandings that have the space to arise. And it isn't always that the aha moment is going to happen right then. But it does happen that as the mind is quieter, there's less interference. Are you with me on that? Do you know what I'm talking about? How there can be less interference. Yeah. So as Tanisaro Bhikkhu says, he said, mindfulness is what keeps remembering where to stay focused and what to keep doing. Right? Pay attention to the breath, keep breathing. Concentration is what maintains the steadiness of your gaze. I love that. So it takes both the mindfulness and the concentration. Mindfulness is what keeps remembering where to stay focused and what to keep doing. And concentration is what maintains the steadiness of your gaze. And that steadiness takes some energy, right? It takes some faith, some confidence. I'm going to stay right here because I know that that's is beneficial to my mind, to my heart, to my body. And then lastly, like I said, wisdom starts arising from this cultivation of this faith, this confidence, bringing the energy, the mindfulness is steady, the concentration, this non-distracted awareness arises, the wisdom starts to come. And then there are questions that out of that, you know, you can drop in an inquiry that says something like, what do I know to be true? What is true for me in this moment? Or maybe there's an insight into how change is working, impermanence, like really deeply understanding, oh, right now it's like this. Or maybe pain, literal physical pain is present, and you start working with the awareness of, oh, this discomfort or pain in the body. It was over here when I started the practice, when I started this meditation. And now it's actually not there, and it's really shape-shifted, and it's over here. And you start seeing that things are continually changing all the time. One breath is different from this breath to that breath. Starting understanding so much more about our lives. What is the difference between a wholesome thought and an unwholesome thought? How does it affect the heart? How does it affect the mind? These are all kinds of awarenesses that can arise from the steady, steady mind. This is what Gil Fronsdal teaches us about these five spiritual faculties. And Gil is a Bay Area teacher. He says, a mind that's confident, this is the faith, engaged, the energy, mindful and focused, can develop wisdom. This wisdom helps to determine which movements of the mind and heart, which thoughts and feelings are useful. What can we let go of? What should we develop further? With wisdom, we begin to take responsibility, not just for our behavior, but also for our mind and what it does. We notice what is or is not conducive to greater peace. In the way a person practices creates stress, then mindfulness and discernment will show that. if that's what happens. As the mind settles down, we begin to learn how to let go of unskillful thoughts, feelings, and motivations. And here's the piece that I think is so important. The process of practice is self-correcting. It guides the mind to greater peace and freedom. The process of this practice, of this training, is in and of itself self-correcting. And that brings us all the way back to faith, confidence, and trust. We can trust this practice. We can trust our own minds and our own hearts to keep us on track, to know what is supportive, what is unsupportive, to develop the habits that increase our well-being, and to develop the habits that help us learn to let go of what doesn't support us and to know the difference. And this is how this team of horses works, right? When wisdom is found, it leads to this deepening faith and to a stabilizing of energy, to a stronger, clearer mindfulness, more access to the steady, concentrated mind, the strengthening of wisdom. It's self-correcting. It supports us. It's a process. It's a training. And from Bhikkhu Bodhi, who I love coming back to this all the time, he says, just do two things, begin and keep going. Begin and keep going. We need to do that. We need to do that. I'll give the Buddha the last word and then we'll talk with each other. You know, there's a story that in the Buddha's penultimate instructions to his followers as he was dying, he said, strive on with diligence. Strive on with diligence, which has sometimes been translated as move into the future with confidence. And that's the same thing as just do two things, begin and keep going. Just keep going. You can do this. And even if the keeping of the going is the next breath, the next moment, do that. Do that.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.